Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Max.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags, and over the next 30 minutes, I'll bring you the latest headlines from South Africa and around the globe. Whether you're tuning in live or catching the podcast later, stay with us for in-depth conversation with leading business minds, political influencers and key newsmakers. It's everything that you need to stay informed, quick, sharp and straight to the point. It's Tuesday, the 29th of October. On the program today, a new survey shows concern about food security and inequality here in Gauteng. We'll find out what keeps chief executive officers up at night. Three of South Africa's heritage sites are under threat due to sewage, and how digital innovation can help find top talent. New findings from the Gauteng City Region Observatory's Quality of Life Survey reveals an unsettling picture of rising inequality, persistent poverty and public dissatisfaction. As inflation stabilizes, but essential services fall short, residents here in Gauteng are navigating a complex landscape of economic and social challenges. Today, we welcome Rashid Sidat from the Observatory. And first of all, then, you've been part of the study, Rashad. What did it set out to do?
Okay, maybe I should just say that the Gauteng City Region Observatory is basically a research institute, which is a partnership between the Gauteng Provincial Government, Wits University, University of Johannesburg, and Local Government Association in Gauteng. We've been doing this survey now for several years. This is a seventh iteration. We do it every 2 to 3 years. And basically what we're looking to find is a measure of multidimensional well-being, how people perceive their lives, but objectively what their lives look like.
And what are those determining factors? Is there an elegant definition of what a quality of life is in Gauteng?
The way we do it is basically to encompass the economy, basic services like water, sanitation, electricity, governance, health, social cohesion, the environment, their own sense of their own life satisfaction, issues around violence and crime, issues around transport, and the community attitudes. In other words, it's a much broader than, you know, traditional definitions of quality of life, like the Human Development Index, which only has three components to it. Ours has, in fact, has 33 components to our index.
And things aren't looking too good at the moment, are they?
Unfortunately not. We've certainly had improvement since the global pandemic, because we had done a survey actually interestingly during the pandemic in 2020 to 2021, and at that point we hit rock bottom, but we have not improved to pre-pandemic levels. So in other words, even though we went down during the pandemic, subsequently we haven't improved to pre-pandemic levels. So it means that the sense that people's quality of life for themselves is actually deteriorated.
And what specifically are we worried about?
So let me give you a couple of examples. So, for example, 85% of the population say it's harder to find a job. It's down from 70% in 2011, for example. Poverty rates are pretty desperate at the moment. 16% are at the food poverty line, which is the lowest level. It did go down to 23% during COVID, but in fact is above the pre-COVID levels of 12%. And I think most worryingly, 26% of adults say they've skipped a meal in the last year or on several occasions, and one-fifth of all children in the households that were surveyed basically also said that they skipped a meal because there was not enough food in the household.
This is very worrying, Rashid. So what is the impact then if you have so many people in ostensibly the country's economic powerhouse so dissatisfied with their lives?
Well, of course, it's a big concern for society as a whole. Certainly government number one, and I think it really gets reflected in the satisfaction of government, and that is actually at its lowest level ever for national, provincial and local government. But I think it's for civil society as well, for business. I think for everyone needs to be concerned that there is very deep and widespread poverty within this province, which is actually the most populous. You know, we have a quarter of the country's population. So the numbers are absolutely enormous, and that something needs to be done. I think that we need to think about even the social security that we currently have, the systems. In fact, our figures show us that 50% of the population is on one form of social security or another, including the social relief of distress grant, the 350 Rand grant. In spite of that, we still have this kind of dire situation, which basically, you know, we're saying needs to be addressed collectively by it's an all of society kind of response that is required.
Look, I'm not asking you for a single solution here, but putting more money that we don't have into fixing the problem is simply unaffordable, though, isn't it? We need a new paradigm of thinking here, and I'm not sure if anyone's really got the answer to that.
Well, exactly. I mean, I think, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, the fundamental solution to this problem is, you know, will have to be growing the economy, growing the size of the pie, as it were. We need growth. We need investment. And the conditions for that needs to be created in society by government. Business also needs to come to the party. And ultimately, we need some kind of social compact, which will basically say that we need a kind of positive response. And maybe the idea that has been floated around a national dialogue needs to happen pretty soon, so that, you know, the give and take that we require of all of the social partners, business, labor, government and civil society, all need to come together and say, this is our contribution that we're making to a societal endeavor to address the challenges that we face.
And that idea has been on the table for a long time, but at this point it looks very stillborn, doesn't it?
And I'm not so sure. I think that it's going a little slowly, but it has been revived, as you know, just before the elections, and it still has some traction. So I don't think it's actually stillborn as such.
We have a lot of disparity in this province. Does the survey break it down further in terms of quality of life as per gender, age, and even provincial geography?
Well, I don't have the data as such, but
just broadly.
Definitely. Gender, we do know that women are significantly more disadvantaged, without a doubt. We know that young people are disproportionately those that are, you know, in needs of jobs are basically have a much higher level of unemployment. We also know that in terms of, on a spatial basis, that people who live in informal settlements and in townships are generally poorer than their counterparts in suburban areas. I mean, that's also intuitive and well known. But our data shows it up very clearly, and people who live in informal inner city areas as well. So I mean, we can delineate exactly where the target should be on a spatial basis, but we also know that on a sort of transversal basis, meaning like, you know, women and young people, that a specific target needs to be done there as well.
Rashid Sidat, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
As African chief executives navigate a complex environment of geopolitical shifts, emerging tech and sustainability pressures, the inaugural KPMG Africa Chief Executive Officer Outlook is highlighting the strategic priorities and risks that these leaders face. Joining us now is Stefano Modic, who is Global Geopolitics Lead at KPMG, to explore how these chief executives are balancing growth and resilience amid unique regional challenges. So, Stefano, what exactly then is the paradigm here?
Indeed, very exciting times with the release of our African CEO. And you're right, that is the balance we need to strike, is between resilience and growth. And unfortunately, geopolitics can get in the way of growth for those CEOs, those businesses that are not prepared. In terms of the list, you know, I'm skeptical of having a list that applies a one-size-fits-all approach to geopolitical risk. We do have a lot of macro analysis of what are the main trends out there that business leaders need to be aware of. Probably number one is the shift in the geopolitical era of from a unipolar world to a multipolar world that makes everything more complex. There's fragmentation of trade. There's a proliferation of trade barriers as countries try to secure the supply chains, and political alliance considerations become more important than economic efficiencies. And all of this contributes to the inflationary pressure that we see in the system. So that's what's happening at the systemic level. But then very much every business has its own geopolitical risk and opportunity exposure. And I'd like to emphasize that it's not just about the risk and not just about the rainy days, but it's also about preparing that umbrella for the rainy days so that you can find the opportunities also in this shifting geopolitical landscape. So I always advise companies to really do a tailored analysis of what their exposure is. Because for someone, something can be a risk. For example, very, very interesting, what's happening in the Red Sea with commercial shipping being disrupted by activities from the Houthi rebels in Yemen. Well, that is actually benefiting a lot of South African ports, right? There's been a lot of diversion of routes. True, from a macro-systemic perspective, everything is less efficient. Things are going to cost more. Those goods are going to take more time to reach their final destination because they can't go through the Suez Canal. But that's generating more revenue for South African and Western ports. So that's the bottom line, is geopolitical risk and opportunities are very much tailored to each and every business. And there are some big macro trends that everyone needs to be aware of.
And I would also suggest to you that no longer can a chief executive simply hunker down and focus on their city or their region. One is that they have to have a worldview, they have to have a position, and they also need to be adept enough to move and pivot very quickly.
100%. So the way we like to talk about it, when I speak to our clients around the world, I say that CEOs or someone else in the executive management team needs to be elevated to a chief political officer. This is not a formal role. It's just a way to say that just thinking about commercial priorities, finance numbers, market strategies is no longer sufficient. Because as you said, we reached a level of interdependence globally in the global economy through 20, 25 years of unfettered globalization. Now we see rise of conflicts, rise of geopolitical tensions that are putting that somewhat into a risk perspective. I don't agree with those analysts that say that we are in a deglobalization. I just think that things are becoming a little bit more complex. And I think that business leaders need to have the political nous on top of their commercial nous to be able to navigate these new uncharted waters where politics really matter. And it's hard to distinguish between facts and fiction and signal and noise in the boardroom and in the executive management team these days. So it's important to have the expertise that you need internally, sometimes externally with external experts, to really help you map out what your geopolitical risk and opportunity exposure is and try to make the most of the opportunities and shelter you from the risks.
How are chief executives, Stefano, adapting to the need to attract and retain talent amid one, shifting workforce dynamics, because often borders have become very fluid, and add into that mixer the contribution of artificial intelligence?
Yeah, look, I'm not the talent expert. I must preface this. The person who's the talent expert within the team that worked on the CEO report is Dr. Candice Hartley. But look, the bottom line, you hit on the nail on the head there. There's massive shifts in the workforce. One is the generational change. I deal a lot with demographics in my role as geopolitical analyst, and there's a big demographic shift in place around the world. Africa is actually going to be by 2050 the only place in the world where demographic growth will 90% of global demographic growth will be concentrated in Africa. So it will become a big talent pool. But in the meantime, because we have demographic collapse in so many parts of the world, we have a consequent decline in workforce availability, in productivity, and we have at the same time the investment in these critical technologies that will try to provide a solution to some of these talent challenges, including AI, as you said. So CEOs will really have to really focus on this, the generational change, also what new generations want in the workforce. I think, you know, Gen Zers are very different from millennials, are very different from Gen X and very different from boomers in terms of the way that they see the workforce. So they need experts that advise them on these generational differences and how to get the best out of what each generation has to offer in terms of they're just leniencies, there's areas of expertise. You know, they say Gen Z are more tech savvy, but might be a little bit more. This is obviously a generalization, right? Every person is different, but on tendency, they might be a little bit less extroverted or vice versa. Millennials are probably not as diligent and not as conscientious, but they're really good in social context. These are just some ideas. I think there's a transition in place. There's challenges with obviously productivity challenges. There's also the geopolitical risk context that poses risks to growth. And at the same time, you have the rise of AI and other technologies that can help you facing some of these risks to your productivity gains. And so, yeah, I think that's absolutely an area of laser focus that CEOs need to.
And Stefano, finally, and just a quick one, and back perhaps to the more practical work of a chief executive. You've spoken about geopolitical risk and geopolitical tension. There's also increased geopolitical competition, and that has an obvious impact on supply chain strategy.
Yeah, 100%. So that's what I was referring to at the beginning. Now we have a proliferation. The IMF earlier this year released a report from memory. We've seen about more than 2,000 new trade barriers of trade and policy, industrial policy measures imposed around the world by governments, and about two-thirds of those are trade restrictive in nature. And the idea of some of these policies, you know, think about what's happening in the US in the semiconductor industry space, but also AI itself. Governments are trying to secure their supplies. One other area that is extremely important for Africa is the race to critical minerals as the world moves towards a green energy transition. And the need for these critical minerals is going to skyrocket in the next decade. And a lot of these critical minerals are located in key African countries. And we have countries driving policies and setting strategies to secure the supply chains. And this is increasing the competition, right? It's no longer about let's just develop global supply chains, regardless of how complex they are, in a way that they make sense from an economic efficiency perspective, because the world is relatively safe. We all sort of get along, and the contentions are on the margins, and that's what we should focus on. That was the paradigm of, you know, the 1990s and the early 2000s before the financial crisis. Now, Countries are racing to secure supply chains in critical industries, in industries and goods that are deemed important for national security purposes. And this is adding a challenge to global business that are not really used to this new world, the new modus operandi. So they need to get on board. They need to invest in establishing good relationships with government stakeholders, try when they can to proactively shape the regulatory environment in which they operate, and be on top of this, or these massive changes in the supply chain space, so that they can jump on the bandwagon when there's a policy incentive, and also they can shelter when there's a policy that actually goes against its interest in terms of how these supply chains have been restructured.
I do like that notion of the chief political officer. I am going to leave it there. Stefano Moric, global geopolitical lead or geopolitics lead at KPMG. Thank you so much for talking to me. Appreciate the time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Three of our prized World Heritage sites are under serious threat from untreated sewage. The Greater St. Lucia Wetland Park, the Cape Floral Region and Robben Island are all at risk, with pollution levels impacting both the ecosystem and communities. More now from Professor Emeritus Leslie Petrick from the University of the Western Cape's Department of Chemistry, who has been working on research in this respect. And Professor, first of all then, what has led to this crisis?
Well, look, one of the facts that we all have to live with is that service provision has become the least of the government's priorities. clearly there is no effort to maintain or expand wastewater treatment plants in the country, and many of the communities are completely unserviced. But even the communities that are serviced, their infrastructure is aging and collapsing under the huge amount of additional sewage that is being generated by the population. We clearly have a government that has no foresight and that encouraged population growth without thinking about the necessary infrastructure that goes with such a population growth. That's the first thing. The second thing is obviously having skilled technical people to do the work. You can't put a person in charge of a wastewater treatment plant that's a political pawn rather than a technically skilled, trained person without having problems. We've analysed the situation pretty carefully. A large group of us under the leadership of a professor at Wits did a study on it. And there are many integrated reasons for the problem that we're facing, but those are the key ones. Now, the trouble is that if you do not treat your wastewater, you're polluting your rivers and you're polluting your seas. And what we're seeing at Mogale City and at the Cradle of Humankind and also at the Vredefort situation and at Robben Island is all a result of the fact that sewage is not being treated and it's being released into the marine and riverine environment without consideration of the downstream impacts. We have to realize that sewage is actually full of pathogens. E. coli and enterococci are the measures that are taken because these indicate fecal pollution, but these are not the only organisms that are present in that sewage. You have a whole range of bacteria and viruses and, of course, parasites like worms present in that sewage that will affect the health of people that are in contact with that water. But more so, these are World Heritage sites we're talking about. And that means that we have a responsibility to the rest of the world to see that those sites are kept pristine for future generations to be able to marvel at what those sites represent.
Professor, let me ask you this question. In terms of treating the problem, if we have the infrastructure repaired, if budget is found for this, is it, in your opinion, a fairly easy fix, or do you think we've crossed some sort of line here?
Well, if the infrastructure was repaired and maintained and augmented, we might be able to reverse some of the damage. Species loss is, of course, ongoing because of this problem. The thing is that the sewage is not only full of pathogens, it's also full of chemicals. And I've just recently participated in a study which showed the dreadful extent of perfluorinated compounds that are contaminating our waters. That's just one of them. There are pharmaceuticals, there's pesticides, there's industrial chemicals. And those chemicals are obviously what is hugely toxic to living organisms. And especially in an environment like Robben Island, which is supposed to be a pristine environment, you must realize Robben Island is not just a World Heritage site, it's also the home of an endangered species, the African penguin. And it's a marine protected area. And we are picking up all these chemical compounds in the sediments, which means the beach sands, and the seawater, and in mussels, and in penguin eggs that we have tested. So these compounds are busy contaminating living organisms to the extent where it's affecting the chances of survival and creating extra stress on an endangered species that does not need extra stress at this point in its fight for survival.
Professor, you're painting a very gloomy picture here. As a result of all the work that you and your colleagues have done, has there been any response so far from those in charge?
Well, look, the city of Cape Town is starting to allocate budget towards expanding and upgrading the wastewater treatment plants in the Western Cape. I have heard talk of this being also a part of the plans up in the Gauteng region, and one can just hope that these things happen in the near term, not in the far term. You know, the trouble is that talking about allocating budget is different from actually allocating the budget, and then getting the tenders in place is another long story. In Cape Town, for instance, the arguments about the tenders have put some of the work back by 10 years or more. And, you know, once the tender is allocated, it still takes time until the project is completed. So we're looking at the nearest future is probably 5 years from now, possibly 10 or 20 years, if people get going right now. And the trouble is, because of the short-termism of our politicians, what one set of officials decide on is not necessarily carried through by the next set of officials. And then one has to start all over again. I mean, to give you an idea, we started raising an alarm about the sewage pollution around Cape Town in 2015. And at the moment, the only wastewater treatment plant that is receiving some attention is Potsdam and possibly Foray. But other than that, the other wastewater treatment plants are still woefully inadequate and are spewing out a very poorly treated sewage into the marine environment and into our local rivers here in the Western Cape.
All right. I am going to have to leave it there. Time, regrettably, is against us. But thank you very much indeed for sketching out what is obviously a very, very critical situation. I do appreciate it. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Finally on the program today, as we near the end of this year, companies are realizing that digital learning and development strategies are no longer optional if they want to retain top talent. Kira Koopman is with us now, head of L&D Strategy and Digital Learning at Momentum. And first of all then, Kira, how big a problem or how big a gap do we have when it comes to digital learning?
I think the gap is probably bigger than we expect, but for a number of different reasons, Jeremy. I think, you know, we forget that employees are also users of digital technologies. We're on social media, we're using our phones every day, we're communicating via WhatsApp and Teams and Slack and all the rest. And so we are digital users by nature, but I think in general, certainly from an employee experience and learning and development perspective, we're not always meeting employees where they are. So we expect employees to come to a separate platform, to engage with us in a way that it almost isn't intuitive, you know. And so I think the gap is twofold. The one is, you know, the gap from between employees and employers, and employers really understanding how to meet employees where they are. And the other gap is a digital literacy gap in general, you know, understanding how to use technology in the workplace to upskill, to kind of, as our chief learning officer says, to learn in the flow of life. And so I think it's about meeting each other in the middle. Mm. You know, how can employers meet employees where they are and use technology to enable that meeting place? And how can employees upskill themselves to be productive, to participate and collaborate within high-performing spaces digitally?
Kira, let me play devil's advocate here and push your thinking a little bit. given that organizations these days, and particularly within the South African paradigm, are employing more Gen Z and millennials,
yes.
Those skills, yes. Are they not there already? Are they not... is there not a baked-in intuitive
Absolutely.
Approach here?
Absolutely. So, for example, my team are predominantly Gen Zs. We work from home and we make use of digital tools and technologies to interact with each other. So, you know, we are dispersed across the country and Gen Zs are absolutely comfortable communicating and engaging with each other online. I think the gap there is that there is an older workforce who are managing these individuals who are not as comfortable, you know, participating in a digital or virtual workplace. And so we try to, you know, kind of force old analog ways of working onto a generation that is very comfortable collaborating and working efficiently online. And so again, it's about meeting in the middle. You know, what is that kind of sweet spot of using digital technologies to enable our workforce? And similarly, you know, with Gen Z and younger millennials, understanding that there is a magic in working collaboratively in a face-to-face environment as well.
Is there a direct correlation between digital upskilling and productivity?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we no longer make use of things like fax machines and post boxes to do our work. We are communicating digitally. And so if we want to be efficient and if we want to be productive as a workforce, we have to be able to use the tools that everybody else is using to be able to communicate, to share information, to upskill, to get things done. And so that digital literacy component is a critical one in this day and age. Mm,
I have fond memories of the fax machine, Kira, but we don't need to go there. But let me ask you this. Yeah. Given that technology is changing so quickly, it becomes more and more difficult, I imagine, for corporates to keep up with the change and also know what to teach and what to jettison.
Correct. Yeah, you are absolutely right. And so I think a fundamental priority is less on the types of technologies, but rather on the impact of digital in general on how people engage with each other. So at Momentum, we have a strong focus on tech talent upskilling. How do we embed AI across our organization in an ethical and strategic way? So less on the tools, but more on the technology. And then at the same time, developing the people side of that as well, because technology isn't going to get rid of all of our jobs. Mm. It's going to change the way that we do our work. And so focusing on the you know, the soft skills or the power skills in combination with how do I use technology in a way that it's meaningful and impactful is really how we kind of become more strategically competitive.
And just a final one then, what advice would you have for companies that haven't yet embraced digital learning into their talent strategy? Where do they start?
It can be very overwhelming if you are not comfortable with digital, if you haven't embraced digital yourself. So I think if you're starting from scratch is to start as an individual, take an online course, understand your own learning preferences, and then think about the employee experience. Where are they already engaging with each other? How can you place learning in those online communities, within a Teams channel, within a Slack channel? Because I think we also forget that learning happens organically wherever we are. If we don't understand something, we seek out the information to close that gap. Learning doesn't have to be a formal academic program that you study at a university. It can be listening to a podcast on your way to work. It can be watching a YouTube video. And so there are lots of ways that we can learn and that we are already learning digitally. It's about translating those habits and principles of learning into the workplace and really meeting employees where they are.
Okay, Kira, I'll fax you a copy of the... Thank you very much for joining
Amazing.
Us today.
Thank
and that's
you,
critical information. Kira Koopman from Momentum.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much. Appreciate your time. And that also informs our online poll question today. Does your company have a digital learning strategy? If you do or if you don't or you're thinking about it, you can participate either on our LinkedIn or X feeds. And that is also our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.